This is Vicki Davis and Sharon Peters and Jennifer Wagner interviewing Patrick Crispin. We have just heard his incredible new presentation, Crispin's Guide to What's New and What's Next. And it was so exciting, and I'm teaching my students about hardware right now, and I just learned so many new things. In particular, I think people need to know about IPTV. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, what's happened is, unfortunately, cable is just not very efficient way to transmit pictures and things like that. Because technically, a digital cable signal that comes into your house has 400 channels, but you're watching two. You might be watching one and recording another, but so you've got 398 channels that are coming there to your box and not going any further. It's just wasteful. So the cable companies have been making lots and lots of money recently, and the telephone companies are realizing, well, wait a minute, we spent all this money on this broadband technology. You know, I bet we could find a way to put television signals over that broadband technology. And gosh, you know, if you think about it, you don't need 400 channels going to a house. You need two. We can do that now. And that's what IPTV is all about. It's basically television brought to you by the telephone company instead of from the satellite or from a cable company.
So what you said, you talked about it would be a way to bring closed-circuit television basically to a school. Can it run over your Cat 5 network?
Absolutely. What's going to happen is you're going to need to have some sort of converter box that's going to go, you know, probably behind the television that's going to take the IP signal and convert it into something, you know, probably going to be an analog signal for the old televisions. My guess is Linksys is going to make something that's going to be $100 or something like that very shortly. But right now, IPTV is limited for rural areas. The Department of Agriculture actually based on ideas in the 1930s where they were saying, okay, all these rural parts of America don't have electricity, let's go electrify them. And these sort of standalone independent entities, these rural electrical societies or organizations, were kind of given the freedom to run what they wanted. And recently they were given money saying, hey, you guys want to set up your own networks and do you want to do this? So there are about 300,000 people right now with IPTV, but as you watch television, you're going to see AT&T, you're going to see SBC, you're going to see all the big telephone companies drop hints about television. And you're going to go, wait a minute, you're a telephone company. It's IPTV they're talking about. They're talking about the telephone company providing television, and they've been raising the flag left and right, and it's happening next year.
Well, what's so exciting to me is my students, for example, when we did SAT prep, we took the Latin root words, and I had to make videos of funny ways to remember the root words, and they showed it to every student all over the school. And I had students that I didn't even teach come back and say, Miss Vicki, I knew all the root words because I was sitting there laughing my rear end off all the way through the SAT because of that. And if there was a way to deliver that video to every classroom, then classrooms could be learning from each other as they're making videos, and you end up having the whole school learn together.
Absolutely.
Instead of having individual classes. But it's been pretty expensive, though.
Yeah, what's happened is you'd have to set up your own special sort of in-school network that required special cabling. It wouldn't run on the current cabling, so you'd probably have to pull fiber to each classroom and terminate that, which is, you know, ridiculous at every termination. Plus, you'd have to have a special box in the closet to do. It ended up being so expensive that only the richest schools had closed circuit. But if you think about it, if we're doing television over basically Cat 5, Cat 6 cable, you've got that.
Right.
It's there already. Plug in a jack in the wall and plug it into the back of the TV. What's great about this for the classroom is, yeah, this is going to take some bandwidth. It's going to take some bandwidth in the school, but say you have 20 classes, not all of them are going to be using that, and they're only going to be getting one channel or two at a time, so it's not going to soak your bandwidth completely.
So how long do you think till this will be available in the classroom?
2010.
Okay, so 2010 then. Okay, I'm going to stop this one. As you talked about a lot of the new technology, you brought up two things that I think people need to be aware of as they're making their technological purchases. Do you think you could tell us a little about those two technologies, starting with HDCP?
Yeah, the two technologies are HDCP and AACS. And it's really just something where the copyright holders are terrified of the genie getting out of the bottle. They're realizing that when you go to high-def television, and especially when you're going with high-def DVDs, you have a pure digital signal, and it's perfect. It's better than anything that's ever been released. And they're absolutely terrified that the genie's going to get out of the bottle, they're going to lose their content, there's going to be some sort of Napster for movies, and they're going to go bankrupt. Scares the living heck out of them. So, what the folks in Hollywood are trying to do is they're trying to put into the new technology very restrictive copy protection. HDCP is a first example. It's high bandwidth digital copy protection, or actually digital content protection. And both HDCP and AACS work on a token-based system, meaning that it's not just a cable that's going between your computer and your screen or your digital player and your television screen, but the signal itself is going to be encoded with a little flag, and the box that sends the signal will have to have the flag, and the television will have to have the flag, and they can't read it. The signal's going to be downgraded to what we're seeing today, which is 480i NTSC, you know, plain television signal. So you'll go out and spend a gazillion dollars on like a 700-inch flat panel display with the most expensive HDMI cables you can possibly imagine, and you'll find that one piece in the chain is not compliant, and your picture's going to look no better than a regular television.
So if you buy HDTV television today, can you get HDCP compliant?
Yes. What you want to do is, when you buy it, you're going to be looking for a couple things. And what I recommend is you look for a 1080p screen. That has nothing to do with copy protection, but that's sort of better than you could ever possibly imagine. 1080i is okay. 1080p is the gold standard. You want multiple HDMI connectors because you're going to have multiple devices that are using this high bandwidth digital media interface that's going to be plugging into your computer, back to the TV, and you don't want to have to be pulling plugs to connect something else. So you want multiple ones. You want these HDMI to be 1.3, so it's HDMI 1.3, which is HDCP compliant, and you'll look at that. Very hard to find that right now, but that's coming.
So there are people now buying HDTVs for Christmas that aren't going to be able to use them in 4 years, 5 years?
I have one that I won't be able to use in 4 years. I bought one and I didn't realize that it was not HDCP compliant, which means that when the new Blu-ray and HD DVD players come out, we don't know, and when they're not, you know, at the cost of a, you know, mortgage payment, I may not be able to play a signal from that on my TV because my TV may not be able to recognize the flag, meaning that the player will downgrade the signal before it shows up on my TV. I'll be able to see a picture, but it'll be 480i instead of 1080p.
So you won't get all the quality out of that.
You're not going to get the quality you paid for.
Now, you also talked about a protocol that had to do with the burning of DVDs.
Yeah, AACS, and this is something that Intel has been pushing, and this is also token-based. What's interesting about this is that AACS has the ability, through future upgrades, to turn a non-compliant device into a brick. Case in point, say I go out today, I spend $1,000 on a Sony Blu-ray player, hook it up to my TV. I'm getting digital signal, tokens are working perfectly. A year later, somebody somewhere comes up with a way to hack my Sony player, not my particular model, but just or the one that's in my house, but the model itself, to hack it so that they can bypass the digital copy protection. Future discs will probably not play on my box. I'll have to go get a new piece of hardware because the future disc will be written with a copy protection that specifically targets my vulnerable player and prevents it from playing the thing back. That's why I'm saying I think until the whole Blu-ray HDTV sort of fight is carried out, I really don't recommend either Blu-ray or HD DVD yet. there's a big fight going on until the standards come out, and until somebody really deals with this AACS and the problem of, you know, non-compliant devices. I don't think anybody knows about this yet, unless they read Gizmodo or Engadget. You know, this is a really scary piece of information that the Hollywood could basically break your television and force you to buy a new TV.
Well, and I have to wonder as an educator why they don't spend any money on educating about copyrights. Because if you look at the school curriculums, nothing is being put into, you know, educating about Creative Commons or copyright,
right,
or what you can use. And as a teacher, there is literally nothing out there for me to use that anybody has produced.
Well, the RIAA is giving some curriculum away. It turns out their curriculum's wrong. A lot of the people who are coming up with the curriculum that is available for free are telling students things that just aren't factual. There are people out there who hate Creative Commons. They think Creative Commons is creative communism. and that's what it's been called. And, you know, Creative Commons is one of the greatest things ever for education. You have
Absolutely.
The ability to find content where the user says, yeah, take it, here are the requirements. You know, and Google supports Creative Commons and they're searching, but there are very few people who know about it. I guarantee if you go to a high school today and ask the students about Creative Commons, in a 2,000-person high school, 5 people know about Creative Commons.
My students know because they are shooting videos, I make them research it, and there was an old Tom Jones song they wanted to use, and interestingly, he has Creative Commons licensed some
Isn't
of his
great?
Music. And they were so excited, and they've had several thousand people view this video.
Isn't that great?
Okay. I'm going to stop this one. Do y'all have any questions? I don't want to take all your time.
No.
Tell us if we're... Patrick, the thing that stuns me about watching your presentations is that I feel like I keep up with things and that I read a lot. And you always come up with these things that nobody knows. And then I go out there and I find it on the internet and it's right there, but I didn't know it. And I'm trying to teach students to be lifelong learners.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you teach yourself this new information?
Well, I think part of it is that I really love the concept of finding out what's next in the technology world. So you have to have the desire to do it. You can't force that desire in somebody. For example, if you wanted to ask me what the latest dance moves are, I ain't going to be able to tell you. I don't know, and you aren't going to make me learn it. But what I normally do is there are about 15 or 20 blogs that I read each and every day, and I just want to keep up to date with what's going on. You know, I start with the general blogs like Boing Boing,
right,
boingboing.net. For the tech blogs, Gizmodo and Engadget are huge. I read those religiously multiple times a day. And then I go through the tech news sites, so, you know, anything from news.com, or actually news.com.com, which makes no sense.
Okay.
And didn't you know, that's our webpage address, news.com.com. And then there's actually something from the Chronicle of Higher Education called the Wired Campus Blog. Slashdot is a great place to find out what's going on. And I know educators are kind of predisposed to hate this site. Wikipedia is wonderful for tech news. If you want to find out about HTCP and AACS, that's the way to do it. The other thing that I do is a lot of, you know, the magazines that I read, I get a lot of stuff from Maximum PC. The folks at Maximum PC are really, they were the ones who kind of informed me about HTCP and AACS way before it even appeared on the web. And now we're starting to hear more about this going, ooh, yeah, that's probably important stuff. So really, if you can find a bunch of sites that you like, just keep reading them every day, and you'll find things that kind of pique your interest. For example, I've been talking to conferences for a year about the new iPod video, which is not going to have any movable parts. It's just going to be a screen, and you move your finger on the screen to do it. We know that's coming. Everybody knows it. The iPod phone, we know. I mean, it's November. I guarantee you by the summer there will be an iPod phone because it just makes sense.
Right.
There's going to be a telephone from Apple that's an iPod.
Convergence.
It's happening.
Yeah.
Do you have a blog, or have you ever thought about doing a podcast for educators?
I've had a lot of people ask me about that, but I'm kind of, as hard as it is to believe, I'm so humble that I don't think I have anything to contribute to the world on that matter. So it's like, I just...
Wow.
Yeah, because most of the stuff I find it other places. So, you know.
Well, as I can tell you, I don't believe anybody would want to read my blog either. And now I have over 600, so
that's great.
You know, that's good for a teacher who does it part-time. Let me stop it. Now, how can people reach you to get you for conferences? And I can say, as someone who's watched you for 3 years, of course, you didn't meet until this year, but I've always been to your stuff to keep up with things, that you are a great person for educators because you make it very simple, and I really appreciate that as
Thank
an
you.
Educator. So how can people reach you and get you for conferences?
Well, first of all, if you don't want me for a conference but just want to take my material, if you go to netsquirrel.com, as in I'd like to catch a squirrel in the net, click on the left on PowerPoint files. I've got all my PowerPoint presentations up online. All of my new ones are Creative Commons, non-commercial attribution share alike 2.5. So take them. They're up there, and there are 30, 40 of them that are free. If you'd like me to come and speak at a conference, you can contact me through the form on my website. Just there's a contact form. I don't do many of these as much because I do have to take vacation from work to come out and do this, mm-hmm. and Governor Schwarzenegger doesn't give me as much vacation as I'd like, but I love doing this, and I can't believe that people actually show up and hear me speak. I'd be doing this if nobody showed up, but it's all about doing good for the sake of good.
And the last question is about Presentation 2.0. I've heard two speakers talk about it today, and I know that I think the fellow at Apple, Jobs,
Steve
did a presentation, and he had like one word on each slide,
yes.
and maybe that was when it was coined. But tell me just a little bit about Presentation 2.0 and what it means to use a presenter.
I actually tried for the first time what's called Presentation 2.0. Normally, my presentations have way too many words on the page, but I do that deliberately because I don't want people taking notes. They can just go home, download the entire presentation, and it's more like a journal article than a real presentation. Presentation 2.0 is where you are very specific and you talk about one particular point. You put that point on the screen and nothing else to distract. So it's either a picture or a word or a couple things. For example, when we were talking about February 17, 2009 and how digital signal is going to happen on that day, analog dies on that day for television. You know, I just had the date and then I would explain what's going on. The best example I've ever seen of Presentation 2.0, if you do a search for Identity 2.0, guy from Canada did it. It's a 15-minute presentation. He used an ungodly number of slides. To do it well, to do a real Lawrence Lessig-type Presentation 2.0, you literally need to write down everything you're going to say and then find the necessary slides to put it in. So it takes a long amount of time, but it's actually a really exciting way to get people's attention. But do a search for Identity 2.0, and you'll see a presentation. It's a 15-minute presentation talking about what the future of identity is. Guy from Canada did it, and it's
down,
yeah, I think it may be.
Down, yeah.
Yeah, and it's
it's
just a brilliant presentation. You look at this and go, okay, and it's something to aspire to, but it is a lot of work. As a matter of fact, of the 9 different presentations I've got at this conference, 1 is Presentation 2.0, and that took a month to put together.
Well, I teach PowerPoint to one of my classes, and everything is the 5x5 rule.
Yeah.
So it sounds like we're going to be at the 1x1 rule.
I think that may be the future is 1x1, because really we've seen so many bad PowerPoint presentations over the years. And you know,
reading it.
As a matter of fact, the next workshop I'm going to do is, now that I know PowerPoint, how can I use it to teach, where we show that because of bad PowerPoint presentations, student learning actually decreases by 10% on fact-based tests when you add, you know, really just the cognitive dissonance on a page, and we kind of talk about how to take care of that, how to deal with reading styles and things like that. And there's not enough research in this field. PowerPoint's been in the classroom technically since 93, 94, been in K-12 since 98, I guess, and it's something that very few people have done real research on, and it's frustrating, but the research is showing that we're doing it badly.
Well, and we get, and teachers get smart boards and they throw PowerPoints up and they say, oh, I'm using my smart board.
No.
They're not. They're just having a PowerPoint.
Click, click, click.
Fascinating.
Okay.
Now, we learned about RFID tags, and we want to talk a little bit about that. Jen has reminded us, and it's just really an interesting but also scary technology. So would you tell us a little bit about that and specifically about the passports?
There's a privacy concern about RFID, and it's not that the RFID tag tells anything about you, but what technically could be done is somebody with a high enough receiver could technically see what you have on your person, what you bought at the grocery store as you drive out of the grocery store parking lot. They could actually, with basically an antenna, look at all that information and collect that data. By the end of this year, every single passport in the United States will have an RFID tag in it. And the concern is that a terrorist could technically, using an antenna, target Americans overseas. Just by going, okay, you're not an American, beep, 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 die. The Americans have tried to deal with that by putting shielding in the covering of the passport so that when you open the passport, it could be read, but when it's closed, it can't be read. But still, there's serious security concerns about that. And the encryption that's being used right now can be hacked by a two-year-old.
Now, my class said RFID 2 weeks ago, and the question I have is, are these active or passive? I know active actually send a signal out, and passive have to be, sort of bounced off of like something from a submarine. What are the ones that are going in passports?
These are passive. But again, all you need to do to, if you're within a certain range, you just fire up the signal and ping it, and there it is. And because the encryption is so bad, you can actually get some personal information, like date of birth,
identity theft. If you travel overseas
could be an issue.
Or anywhere, if you have a passport on your person, your identity theft.
I think this was poorly conceived. I think nobody's really taken the time to think about it. But I think the RFID passports we're going to be hearing about them next year.
Can I extend it just a little bit?
Sure.
I would like to know. I just feel we are gullibly going into having numbers placed inside our bodies by this, because people are not going to want to have them in their passports because that seems scary. So do you just think that people are accepting technology so easily right now that they're not even looking at the fears and the possibilities of what could come out of this?
I think with the RFIDs there are concerns that haven't been addressed. I know that there is, and I think it's in Malaysia, where they're trying implants where you can do like the old Jedi mind trick and raise your, wave your hand in front of the police officer, this is not the person you want, and, pass them your information. But I still don't see that happening here in America. I know that there was concern when Walmart went to RFID on pallet-based shipping. RFID hasn't gone to item level yet. There is talk about Walmart trying to push for that. I think there's a lot of pushback on that. There's a lot of privacy concerns about that. If they can find a way to deactivate the RFID at the door, like a self-destruct, that might solve it. Because then Walmart could do, with an antenna in the ceiling, instantaneous inventory.
Mm-hmm.
But once it gets out the door, it can't be used to track.
Well, and aren't they trying to reach, the one penny level? My husband's in manufacturing, and the one penny threshold is supposed to be the magic number.
They're real close to it. They're real close, from what I understand. They're about a nickel right now is what I'm hearing, and they're getting cheaper.
And if you get a passport, you don't have a choice. You have to accept it.
Yeah, there's if you've got a passport right now, keep it. Because if you get the RFID passport, now, you got it. And
so basically you're going to want to have it, but maybe not on your person at all times, which is kind of scary too.
Yeah, because some hotels actually require you to leave the passport with them at the front desk when you check in.
Okay.
That might be a positive thing.
Okay. Any other questions? That was great.
Any questions for you guys?
I have a question about Google.
I got an answer about Google.
Okay. Oh, well, I've used your stuff a lot. teaching the last 2 years, and I want to thank you for that.
Oh, sure.
I've been wanting to say that for a long time. I'm from Canada. I'm from Montreal, Canada.
Yay!
Yeah. And I passed along your stuff to a lot of teachers as well as students. But I love teaching your stuff about search engines and how to use Google in particular. And I was wondering if you'd ever visited Google and where you got your information from Google and stuff like that.
There are a few things in my life that I'm really, really proud of. One of the things, I write an internet newsletter with Dr. Bob Rankin in Hilton, New York.
I follow it, yes.
We've been doing it for 12 years. I've never met him.
Oh, you're kidding.
12 years, we've never met.
Wow.
I've become a K-12 expert on Google. I know no one at Google. I've never been to the Google campus. But it turns out most of the information about Google is available online. If you go and read the official Google blog, that's where you can get what's going on today. Google has just recently made it easier for you to find their press releases, which used to be really hard to find. And it turns out their press releases have a lot of information. And then the Outer Court Google Blogscope is what it's called, I think, is a great site for speculation about Google. And then whenever Google comes out with a new feature, what ends up happening is the tech blogs write about it, and then the other places write about it. So if you know how to do a Google blog search at blogsearch.google.com, you can find information about how to use Google's new tools before anybody else in the media knows about it.
Do you think Google is becoming the Microsoft of the 90s?
No, I really don't, because Microsoft is based on a subscription model where you're paying a license. Google is all about an advertising model. That's where Google's making their money, is in advertising. And yeah, I think within 5 years, Google will be the place where you go if you want to buy an ad anywhere. If you want to do a radio ad, a print ad, you go to Google, and they'll be doing the advertising for everybody. So I'm not sure how that really competes with Microsoft, where it's, if you want to go with Microsoft, you've got to buy their products. Google's actually doing competing products for free.
Right. So we use Google Docs and...
Docs and spreadsheets are wonderful.
But what you just said is totally changing what I thought of YouTube, because they purchased... YouTube, Google did not.
Correct. YouTube!
And now it's like, oh my gosh, it's going to be advertising. They're going to...
Well,
there will be the possibilities of what could happen.
But there are places out there where they do advertising well, and I wouldn't mind sitting through a 15-second...
But I didn't think of it until you mentioned
Yeah,
it.
I wouldn't mind sitting through a 15-second Ford commercial to see the Numa Numa Kid.
Yeah.
If it's a worthwhile video. And there's gold in them, Dar Hills. And the other nice thing about that is Google has shown the propensity to share its profits with the people who are creating the content. So if somebody creates a video at what once was, Google Video, and will eventually be YouTube, and millions of people see it, Google cut the guy a check. And it's like, congratulations, thanks for sending traffic to our site, here's some money. And that's the way Google does it. Google does it with AdSense, where you can put Google Ads on your page.
Almost
and
to my first 100.
I make...
Do you know that...
I'm proud of that.
Well,
so
you have advertising on your website?
I have Google Ads on my website simply to pay for the hosting fee and then, take my girlfriend to dinner.
Because, there's a lot of educators who say, advertising, bad, bad, bad. But couldn't there be a time with all this content we're producing? I mean, my students have produced 20 videos this year to pay for our technology that we may actually... have advertising?
I think I really think that may be a model. It's one of the things that the school boards and the DOEs are going to have to address. But the question is, if you use state resources to create the materials, can you use advertising? I'm not sure I would support using advertising in school, but in a public environment like my website, I'm paying $50 a month for my hosting. If I could put some Google ads and help defer that cost. Okay, I'm going to do that. And they're unobtrusive ads, so...
Well, I think from an educator standpoint, you would want to control what kind of ads. I mean,
you
would only have
that's
certain
nice,
kind
that's
of...
That's the nice thing about Google AdSense is you can control the ads that appear on your site.
Huh. Well, see, I turned them off early on my blog just because of the connotation of, if you have advertising, you may not be in this for the right reasons. So,
do y'all have any other questions?
Yeah.
Great.
It was really funny when I did,